You know, our meditations are going to be continued in the book of Daniel right until Friday night in the will of God. So please make your plans with that in mind. Now we start in chapter 2 tonight. Verse 1, and in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar dreamed dreams, wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Then the king commanded to call the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, for to show to the king his dream. So they came and stood before the king. The king said unto them, I have dreamed a dream, and my spirit was troubled to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans to the king in Syriac, O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation. The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the thing is gone from me. If ye will not make known unto me the dream, with the interpretation thereof, ye shall be cut in pieces, and your houses shall be made a dunghill. But if ye show the dream, and the interpretation thereof, ye shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore show me the dream and the interpretation thereof. Verse 10 says, the Chaldeans answered before the king and said, there's not a man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore there is no king, lord, nor ruler that asketh such things at any magician or astrologer or Chaldean. And it is a rare thing that the king requireth. And there is none other that can show it before the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Now look at verse 14. Then Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men of Babylon. He answered and said to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree so hasty from the king? Then Arioch made the thing known to Daniel. And Daniel went in and desired of the king that he would give him time, and that he would show him the king the interpretation. Now look at verse 19. Then was the secret revealed unto Daniel in a night vision. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of God forever and ever, for wisdom and might are his. He changes the times and the seasons. He removeth kings and setteth up kings. He giveth wisdom unto the wise and knowledge to them that know understanding. He revealeth the deep and secret things. He knoweth what is in the darkness, and the light dwelleth with him. I thank thee and praise thee, O thou God of my fathers, who hast given me wisdom and might, and hast made known unto me, and now what we desire of thee, for thou hast made known unto us the king's matter. Now look at the verse 28. But there is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets, and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. The dream and the vision of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter. And he that revealeth secrets maketh known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest, and behold a great image. This great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. This image's head was of fine gold, his breast and his arms of silver, his belly and his thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet, that were of iron and clay, and brake them to pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broken to pieces together, because and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, and no place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Now then you have, of course, the explanation of that in the next verses. Now verse 47. The king answered unto Daniel and said, of a truth it is that your God is a God of gods and a Lord of kings and a revealer of secrets, seeing thou couldst reveal this secret. Then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief of the governors over all the wise men of Babylon. Then Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. And that will do for our reading. God, as we pointed out yesterday afternoon, has ever been anxious and willing to make himself known to the sons of men. Now that is an important matter. We must remember that apart from prophecy altogether, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament showeth his handiwork. So that God has displayed himself in creation, and there's not a spot on earth where that great revelation of God is not found. That's the preacher that goes to every land. That's the preacher that rises every morning. That's the preacher that no man on earth can fail to hear. But then God has gone further than that revelation of himself in creation. He has made himself known through his chosen people. Now that's important to remember. You see, the world has been divided in the providence of God between the nation of Israel and the Gentile population. You can't deny that. And it's important to notice that when God is making himself known to the Gentiles, he uses his own earthly people to be the instrument to do that. Now just your mind runs quickly, doesn't it, to Joseph going down to make God known in Egypt. Until Pharaoh is convinced, there's a man in whom is the Spirit of God. There's a man that knows what none of our men in Egypt know. You must admit that it was nonetheless true of Jonah when he came out of the fish and announced the message right through the streets of Nineveh. You can't question the fact that here's a Jew in the capital of Assyria walking its streets and declaring God's message and shaking the very throne of the greatest emperor that then existed and bringing the king to sackcloth. You'll have to admit that God was behind that visitation. Now we did spend a good few minutes yesterday trying to speak on these lads that were brought down to Babylon. We wanted to make clear, and we're still emphasizing, in that God now has instruments he's going to use to make known his name in that great city. There's a big proud king on the throne, and he's a mighty man. No doubt never was, and never likely will be, one individual man with so much power. I'm talking about human beings. I'm not thinking, of course, of the exception, our Lord Jesus, but I'm thinking of an earthly monarch that never was a leg of it from that day until this. Worldwide dominion. Nobody to question his mind or question his judgment. No one to ask. He had no need to ask advice. He made decisions. And he kept through them, and all was under his control, as we see in a moment or two. Yet there's a man, and he's ignorant of God. That's a big thing. Oh, dear saints of God, you're going about daily, and you meet with people, and you must admire their greatness. You can't deny that. They make you feel small, don't they? You watch their movements, and you can see their intellect is just sparkling, and you can detect there's a man with super ability. I wish I had the quarter of it, you'll say to yourself. There's a man, a major man, but he's ignorant of God. The little girl that's saved knows what he doesn't know. The old woman that has to spell the big words in the Bible when she comes to them, she knows more than he knows. Born again. Oh, let us remember that the greatest blessing a mortal can have on earth is the knowledge of the Almighty. Now, Nebuchadnezzar played a unique part in the program of time. As he came into power and into dominion, the nation of Israel was subdued, was broken. That nation that God had intended to be the leader of nations, to be the supreme controller of the world. Now it was that in Solomon's day, to a great extent. That nation that God had specially chosen to honor him had turned to idolatry, had become confident in images, and all kinds of idols were worshipped in the land. God was angry with them. And God says, I'll scatter them. And there ceased to be a nation as far as world influence is concerned. That's what happened. Now that introduced something that I want the younger Christians now to just underline this in your memory, best you can now. Never forget it. It introduced a period that's known in the New Testament as the times of the Gentiles. Now the times of the Gentiles began long before Christ was born, and they will continue after the rapture. The times of the Gentiles is that period where the nation of Israel is not the supreme nation of the world, but Gentile powers are in control. I hope that's clear. This passage that we're considering tonight gives us God's revelation through Daniel to Nebuchadnezzar of that wonderful period. And the dream that we'll mention in a moment or two and its interpretation is outlining for us world history as far as empires are concerned, right on to the very manifestation of Christ to set up his kingdom. Now you will please remember, when you're studying prophecy, whatever length you may reach in that domain, you will always remember that the goal of prophecy is Christ. Whether it be his kingship or whatever it is, you'll find that that is the great end in all prophecy. It's to focus the mind upon the great solution that God has for human need. It's found in Christ and in Christ alone. So that our story, as you can easily see, it leads to the great climax of the stone, which is Christ. It cut out with our hands out of the mountain, and it crystals the image that we'll be speaking on in a moment or two, and becomes a great mountain. While all other kingdoms diminish, it expands until it covers the whole earth. You know, I think that's wonderful. But God wants us to see that earthly powers are limited in duration. That earthly powers are limited in their influence. And that earthly powers are nothing to be gloried in, because they all melt down, as we see at the end of our meeting, in the will of God. But there is a kingdom, and there is a king, and there is a dominion, and there is a realm that is eternal. Oh, it's eternal. Now let us be clear on that. You say, but I thought the kingdom of Christ lasted 1,000 years. Yes, the first introduction of it does, but it's eternal kingdom. His dominion will have no end. He never will have to take the crown off his head and say, someone else take that up, I've had my time of it. He's an eternal king as well as an eternal priest. We must be very clear on the portion that's ahead of Christ in this great book of God. Now we come to what we believe is the important side of the thing, and that is this. Here's a lad, as we said this yesterday, and a few others with him, and they're going to bear testimony for God. It's possible when Daniel had his second interview, I mean that's recorded, with the king, with Nebuchadnezzar, he was still maybe in his teens. That's to me very important. And isn't it more than amazing now that a boy in his teens, or at the very longest in his early 20s, had the greatest monarch in the world bowing down before him and worshiping? Is that not amazing? The man that feared nobody on earth, the man that knew no questions and would listen to no nonsense, he's so overwhelmed in the presence of a boy with the knowledge of God and the mind of God that he bows down before him. Gets off his throne, mind you. Acts toward Daniel the way he does toward his idols, and gives honor to that youth that we are amazed even he accepted, but we'll explain that as we go on. That's important. Now what I want you to see in that is this, that God has destined the despised people of Israel, the Jews as you would call them, he has destined them to be honored by the Gentile world. So we must be sure of that. Oh yes, Daniel being honored at the end of this experience is just a picture of his master, the Lord Jesus, for the world that has despised the Son of God. For you remember that Daniel was carried down, he was brought into servitude, and he was mutilated in his body. He was marred in his physical frame, and he was humbled in the lower sense, and he was indoctrinated with that awful corruption of the Chaldeans. The world did its best to ruin Daniel for God. In spite of it all, he's still God's messenger to that Gentile king. Now God enters men's minds in various ways. When it comes to sinners in our land, and most that we would meet with from time to time, God enters their minds through the preaching of the gospel. That's the usual way that God introduces thoughts of himself into the minds of men and women. But Nebuchadnezzar is one of those who didn't know God, and there were no preachers dare go near him, and God steals into his mind and starts his mind operating when he's sleeping and gives him a dream. Now you, of course, immediately read this. Your mind switches to the book of Job, and you're quoting to yourself in visions, in the deep sleep, in visions of the night, and when sleep falleth upon man, God speaketh once, yea twice, and man perceiveth it not. God has always had that avenue into which he can enter and speak into the mind of a man. Nebuchadnezzar knew when he got this dream that this was no ordinary vision. There was something strange about it. And the simple, and he's a shrewd man, you know, don't forget Nebuchadnezzar, no fool. The simple idea that he had in mind was this. Now these boys can tell me the dream, I believe their answer when they tell me the interpretation. And if they can't tell me the dream, then I know that they can't give me an interpretation. For anybody could make up a story, he says, you'd gain the time, you see, if I would tell you the dream, you would soon make up a story as to what it meant. But he says, if you can't tell me the dream, you can't tell the story or explain it to my mind. And that is the attitude he adopted toward these astrologers and so on. Now, will you please notice the way it's worded in your Bible? That the emphasis is on this, that there's not a man can tell the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had. If he won't tell it, there's nobody else can tell it. Now what is that, dear brothers and sisters? What is that? Only just showing us what the Bible constantly shows us. It's man's extremity that gives God opportunity to operate. He always eliminates man. Here's a man and he's paying the fortune, as we would say, to train these astrologers and these Chaldeans and these men, stargazers and fortune tellers and so on. And he has them all educated in his cults and all the ideas all in books and so on. Is this all crammed into their minds? Nobody has. You see, there's in the mind of a man, you know, something that we would need to understand, and that is he just praises to know the future. That's why the fortune teller can make people pay out the money. That's why spiritism is so widespread in the world. Man would love to know the future. I wonder what way I'll be. I wonder what work I'll get. I wonder who I'll marry. I wonder where I live. And I wonder this, I wonder that, and I wonder something else. You know, I used to see them at it when I was a boy. I daren't tell you some of the things, for you'd maybe be practicing them when you'd get time. But mind you, it was amazing how they were trying to find out certain things, even when I was a schoolboy. And some of the tricks you really have thought there would, if you hadn't that knowledge of God and His Word. I'm not going to tell you. I don't do that. But at the same time, now that's what man has always wanted. Did you know this? That the devil doesn't know the future, only insofar as it's revealed in the Bible. I was having a man for a meal one day. He's an American man, so you'd hardly like to see him. He's an old man now. See, you know, I never tell people what I'm going to do and when I'm having my meetings. For see, as soon as you announce it, the devil knows it. But see, as long as I don't announce it, the devil knows nothing about it. That's the way he looked at it. See, you know, he doesn't know anything till he's told. And he says, he's not omniscient. He's not like God. And therefore he says, I don't announce things too much and give him time to overthrow it. You know, the late Mr. Stewart had a notion like that. He used to be a sinner. Don't be making too big a shirt about the meetings. We get a few bills up in the trees just as we're starting. And that'll, the devil, he says, we've no time to plan to get them blocked or to hurt them in some way or other. That was, of course, his own simple way. Now, don't be thinking this is theological, but I have to break off some time or other to keep our minds from getting weary. Now, he's had a dream. He knows there's something in that. Now, let's take a look at it, very simply. What he did say was this. A massive figure, like a human being. It's the figure of a body. Great statue. Now it is mainly composed of metals. The upper part of it here is gold. The next part of it, the arms, down to here, silver. Then the thighs, they were brass. And the legs, iron and clay mesh. The toes coming into iron and clay. That's what he saw. Terrifying sight, you see, because the metals were glittering in his very vision. And he must have shook the king to have a vision like that. Now, if men had sat for years trying to guess what the king had dreamt, they would never have thought of that. For even at the very best, if you were trying to imagine that a man saw an image, you would never think of mixing the metals. Sure, you wouldn't. And above all, you would never think of starting with a gold head and with clay feet. You would certainly know better than that. You see, the whole thing would have been totally different to what a man would have imagined had he been doing it or thinking it out for himself. Now, what was God giving this man? Under the figure of a human body, he's giving the mark, an outline of the empires that would fill up the times of the Gentiles. He's giving him a view of four earthly kingdoms and one eternal kingdom. And he's doing that under this image. Now, would you younger Christians please remember that God uses the human body in a number of ways. Well, I think we should maybe ponder that a little. When God was using his fingers, as it were, to mold the human body, he had a multiplicity of ideas in his mind. That body would not only be for human spirits to dwell in, but it would be bigger than of other things. The nation of Israel, for instance, is likened to a body. You read about it being shaved, and all those different features of the human body are brought into the prophecy of Isaiah. Many a man, you know, has read for years, and he never noticed that the human body is not only a picture of many other things, but it also is a picture of Israel as a nation. We also know that the human body is a picture of the church universal. For as Ephesians points out, that it's the church which is his body, the fullness of him that filleth all in all. And not only is Israel illustrated by the body and the church universal, but the local assembly can be pictured as a body in the first epistle to the Corinthians. And isn't it amazing to see that the times of the Gentiles and the great program in world affairs is likewise illustrated in a human body. What a wonder is our body when God can use it in such a variety of ways to demonstrate certain matters. Now what you want to learn now from this to begin with is that all world empires are in a sense united, just as your body is all one piece. Now God is showing Nebuchadnezzar that is that there's a great unity of empires right from Nebuchadnezzar until it's all smashed by Christ's appearing. There's a great unity in that. Now don't let us forget that. Now had you been watching the destruction of the Babylonian kingdom or watching the destruction of the Grecian empire, you would never have thought that the one that was coming in to take over had any link with the one that had gone by. But you see, they're all united in one body. God sees them all as one. Now, there can be no doubt as to the interpretation of this. Some bits of Daniel could be different with this, but there's no doubt about the interpretation of this. There's the first part. And Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar, you're that head of gold. That is his empire, and the man that was the head of it, he's that head of gold. Now, first of all, you need to ask, why is he called gold? And why are the rest called lesser valuable metals? The answer is simply this, that his kingdom was given him by God. There's something divine about God giving that to Nebuchadnezzar. You see now, and that's where the gold comes in. Then again, you will admit that his type of rule was the nearest to divine rule that the world has ever seen, in the sense that he had nobody under him whose counsel he must accept. You've all been reared like myself in what's known as democracy. And if you were listening, if this was a political meeting, the thumping of the desk and all would be around the fact we must have democracy. And the whole idea in men's minds is this, that democracy is the ideal form of government. But you know, the Bible doesn't believe that, nor teach that. It's the autocratic government that is divine. God's purpose is to center rule in one man. And the nearest to that in the past was Nebuchadnezzar, whom he really slew, whom he really kept alive. He was the head of gold. Now if you measure the human body, I'm not going to be too accurate, but you'll notice that the head is shorter than the other parts of the body that are mentioned. So that the kingdom that Nebuchadnezzar founded, though it was made of gold, it lasted less time than the others. You'll agree to that, won't you? Just about 70 years. In other words, when the captivity, the awful captivity of Israel was over, you will know that then the empire was about to end up that had taken them captives. Look to yourself. The best that earth has is short-lived. Now, your 70 years wasn't a great length of time for a big empire to come. Wouldn't God showing us something like that? Just indeed, the prophecy of Jeremiah had told, before even this is mentioned at all, that there would just be three main kings that would fill up the empire. In, I think it's chapter 37 or somewhere there, of Jeremiah, he actually foretells how many kings would be on the Babylonian throne. So you see that God is aware not only that there's going to be a nation established and is established, but he's aware of its length. Now when that kingdom came to an end, or that dominion came to an end, we have Daniel here to show us that is, Darius the Mede took the kingdom. So it fell into the kingdom of the Medes and Persians. That is illustrated by silver. Now you can easily see that Medes and Persians, just like your two arms, there's two legs to it, two branches to it, and that corresponds to Medes and Persians. So that we call it sometimes the Persian Empire or the Medo-Persian Empire, you can call it whatever way you like, but those two branches, as it were, illustrated by the two arms. They, as it were, the two divided up. Now it wasn't just as autocratic as the kingdom of the Nebuchadnezzar, because it was run by, we might say, nobility, and those were great men. So that you'll notice that Daniel, and he's given honors and so on, but there seems to be always two kings. The thing's not just as single as the first kingdom. Move on from that, and of course we have to drop down to a fuller metal still, and we come to, of course you see the Medo-Persian Empire lasted longer than the Babylonian, and then we come to the Grecian. Again, it's east and west, you see, because the two legs are parted, there's the thighs, and that's again less autocratic than the Babylonian Empire. And so there's the east and the west. Now the Grecian Empire was a marvelous empire of we might say culture and a knowledge of language and writing and art and so on. You see, worldly men, they would hold that up as the most wonderful empire that the world has known. And they're still reading those Greek writings that were penned during the period of that empire. And they still think there are marvelous wisdom and marvelous art and all kinds of skills developed in the Greek kingdom. But you know, God doesn't call it even silver. He says it's just brass. Doesn't count too much with him. Then we come to what, of course, is the most interesting of all, and that is the last one. The legs of iron and clay. Begins with iron. Of course, the Roman power was a strong military power. The Roman might, where every man had to bow to the force of Rome. I'm talking now about the imperial part of it, not the religious idea of things.
Stretching away until you're still driving on their roads in England. You know that, don't you?
Some of the walls that they built are still there. They left their mark as far across as England, and they went afar in the other direction. The two long legs, you know, of the big stuff, stretching away. East and west. But in spite of that, there was merry clay. Someone put it very wisely. There was more mud than metal and so on. There's a difference between mud and metal, isn't there? There's a mixture. Because you all know too well, the democracy always has a weak side to it. But men change their minds. And I'm glad I'm not a politician. And I don't like to see men working on it.
politics amongst the Lord's people and trying to get votes and so on. The Lord preserves. We'll get her a little day and we won't be having to stoop to that kind of thing. Mind you, democracy is a very soft thing. It's a very mucky thing. You wouldn't want people to change their minds. And you try to draw votes this way and draw votes that way and draw votes some other way, and you find they're always different and they always change. The man that they'll push away up at the front in the one time, in 10 or 20 years, they'll just try one and look at Matthew's America. In good spirit. See, the world is such as that. There's the muds in it, you know. Now you notice that the image is, the concentration is on the latter part of it. That's the toes. The ten toes. That means to say that in the latter times, just before the stone comes and smashes up world power, the final manifestation of the Roman Empire will be in a ten kingdom form. So somebody, please, before you go any further, give us a rattle off and tell us what the nations will be that are in that. Now you just maybe would need to stop them. You likely wouldn't be right now when you do the guess, you wouldn't be right. You might only need five, you know, when you're in what, 10 and maybe 9, and I think it's 9 they have it now, and there's back a couple more, and they're going to put maybe 11 until before they're finished. So that won't make good arithmetic for the Bible students. Sure, it won't. That tries to make themselves believe that the common market is the revived Roman Empire. You need to watch, because you see, you have two legs, you know, and you don't put 10 toes in one foot. You men are sensible enough to know that. And you put them on two different feet. So you'll have to have two sets of eyes before you're finished. You'll have to get them somewhere. And they'll come out of it. Don't you worry about that. And that's where the softness, the clay will be set. That's none of these best. Take a look at it, dear child of God. For we need to learn that in these days. Whatever human hand structure deteriorates starts off with gold and ends up with muddy clay. That you might be able to do. Put man to any place you like. Put him anywhere you like. And no matter how well he starts, he's always deteriorating. You know, the worldlings would love to think the world's getting better and we're knowing better how to rule the world now than we ever did. And we're more learned now in the art of government and in the skill of handling masses. And we can do this and we can do that. And you know, you must admit that clay is not easy. I'm sure it's not. There's not much stability about it. And you just wonder what the master's thinking. They're hard to handle, aren't they? You wonder with all the years of experience that men wouldn't know better how to roam the world than they're doing now. Why, sure, any lots of roughs can start them with a few guns that could nearly take over a country and put the government out of power and say we're independent now, we're in control. And the rule of the bullet, you know. And that's what it is. Hardly a year goes by, but some country just a lot of rebels rise up and against the government and they take over and they put everybody else out of there and the refugees start. And you know the tide of, you can see the clay rolling as it were. It's as clear as crystal to any man that has a mind to see it. God has another thought in mind. Now, take a look. You see, I would have thought when the illustration would have come to Christ that he would have come out of sparkling gold. He doesn't come out like gold, he comes out like stone. And he comes out of a mountain. You say, I don't like that. Oh, the stone! The stone! And the mountain! Where do you get the gold? Where do you get the minerals? To make the metal? You have to go to the stone for them. You have to go to the mountain for them. He's the great originator of all. He's away beyond them all. A stone comes on, it smites the toes and smashes them up and then breaks the whole empire. That's the end of all dominion. Father Gentile Rube is concerned, waiting for the other. In other words, I would think we're quite correct when we hold that the goal, the Babylonish Empire, it came in through the Persian. It was taken over by the Persian and the Persian. And the Persian was taken over by the Grecian. And the Grecian was taken over by the Roman. In other words, the same people were there, but the rule was different. And that's why the whole image is smashed. Now, to me, it's amazing. The metals, crushed with a stone, would be so light and still be blown away with the wind and like the chaff of the threshing floor. Is that not amazing? It was so powder that it blew. Well, I don't know whether you had gold dust here. I suppose if you had gold dust fine enough here and did that, you could blow it off the desk here. Now God's Son, when he comes and comes down upon that great image, he'll smash it through, not only pieces, but he'll grind it to powder until the very wind will blow it away. My, it's a light thing, isn't it? Wish worldly men could see how empty the world is. Isn't it well that our hope is built on something better than the world has? Isn't it well we were singing at the start of our meeting, my rest is in heaven, my rest is not here. Dear child of God, those treasures that men would almost sacrifice their life to obtain, they're really not valuables, they're not important. Don't get excited about them. Because when God's judgment comes, they just become dust. The Lord Jesus used that figure, didn't he, in the Gospels? He says, yes, whosoever, he says that he's like the stone that the builders rejected, and he says some will stumble and not an end be broken. And then he says, there'll be others and the stone will fall on them and will grind them to powder. Possibly something like this in his quotation at that time. Now, this stone, now I hope you've noticed that in connection with the image, deterioration was stamped upon it, right down to the dust. Then destruction was its portion. But did you notice that the stone will become a great mountain covering all the earth? They used to talk in our country, you know, about stones growing. You farmer men, maybe you don't know, you didn't hear that, but the stones growing. Do you know why stones grow, brother? It's because the soil washes off them and you think they're growing, but they just come a little bit near the surface. That's the secret of that. They don't grow in that way, as far as I know. And they might, indeed, I'm sorry to tell you, they might develop in your gallbladder or something like that, but as far as earth is concerned, don't worry about them growing in that sense. Now, growing stones is not a great comfort to anybody. But here's a stone that comes a mountain. Now, look, be sensible about the pictures that are in your Bible. You'll blow a long time at a mountain before you blow it away. You'll puff a long time at it. And many a storm can blast at the mountains, but they're still there. You know, those chimneys, sometimes you'll see them sway a wee bit. And those big high rises in other places, they'll maybe they say this way a wee bit, and they might be a bit shaky. But I can tell you, it's a stormy day. You look up the mountain, Sleamish or some of those mountains up there, and then you'll be able to hit with it. They don't go back. Oh, Jesus shall reign where'er the sun doth his successive journeys run, his kingdom stretch from shore to shore, till the moon shall wax and wane no more. Wonderful to think. Oh, wonderful to think that the man, now listen carefully, dear child of God, it's great reality to me, the man that people nailed on a cross and cried out, if you be the king, come down. I come down. He didn't come down. He was taken down. He's been exalted at God's right hand. God has purposes for them, and that is a kingdom that will cover the whole earth.
Now, just one more thought or two before I close, because you see, people have misread their Bibles. Maybe not so many of them here has done it, but quite a number of others. And their idea is this.
I've pondered this over. They say, yes, earthly kingdoms will all come to an end. But Jesus, the Lord, is King. That is in his kingdom now. But his kingdom's not seen. And his kingdom is not a manifest kingdom. It's a secret kingdom. There is a sense in which there is a kingdom in that secret sense.
But whatever you do, don't try to read that into Daniel.
Because those four empires that preceded him were publicly known. They were world known. And just as sure as those empires were world known, his dominion will be an outward dominion, a real kingdom established with a real king sitting upon his throne. And there's no such thing as this amillennial idea that there's no earthly kingdom for Christ. Now, another wee difficulty that might come up, because I'll not be always on earth. You may have to face difficulties that I haven't faced, but I've faced a fair number in the half century from the same.
One of the problems that they would raise to you now, if you were talking to some of these men, for me, you're not stupid.
They say this. To me, they would say, as they think of it, to bring Christ away down from his honored position at God's right hand and to set him on a throne on earth is like taking somebody out of a palace and sticking them in the backyard. That was the figure that was used to me. You couldn't, they said, imagine. You couldn't imagine that God would be so unkind to his beloved son as to humiliate him again and put him down on earth and so on. You see, that's their argument. They say he has any kingdom he has, he has it now. And any kingdom he'll ever have, it's a spiritual kingdom. But that won't tally with the Bible. Because the stone here, now listen carefully, the stone here is not establishing its kingdom, as it were, until it smashes the other. And you men are not so stupid. Very sure that all the preaching that has been done in this world, and has been a good wee bit done over the past 2,000 years, it hasn't smashed the kingdom yet. You're knocked down a world empire. You can see that. How silly men are in their ideas and how far they get off the lines. Now, what I'm trying to establish, and there's no secret about what I'm not trying to get it over without letting you know. What I'm trying to establish is this, that there will be a real earthly kingdom. And Jesus, that was born King of the Jews, will not only be King of that nation, but his kingdom shall stretch the wide world over, and it will be a manifest kingdom. He came personally to set that kingdom up. But that in no way implies that he's going to have a house built for him at Jerusalem. He's a sensible man. And you who have studied the book of Ezekiel know right well that not only will they not be living literally at Jerusalem the way an earthly monarch would live, but that they have a prince, a representative, acting for him in that very city and going to the temple and his representative down here below. And don't be frightened of that. Because the king of the future, he's not going to be living in some backyard or other, or even in some palace or other, but he still be in his majestic dominion, reigning over the earth, in full control, a man in control, but not necessarily a man living in a house down here below. Now, can you follow that?
We would need to just say a little word and then we close. Don't forget,
Daniel's honored here. Daniel's esteemed here. The Gentile power is actually worshipping Daniel. Nurse is something. I know the way you're speaking, but I can really think about it. Please, Daniel didn't have to stop when he went to worship. For you know, the angel did not when John went to worship him in the book of Revelation. Daniel had nothing to say to the great. Oh, never heard that word was fired before. The character said that was never even been a body that he was ever going to be there. And he told me all I know. He's no right to dictate to Nebuchadnezzar what he did. And if sweet odors and so on was being offered, evidently what was in the back of Nebuchadnezzar's mind was this, that behind that boy that I'm talking to, there's the God that I don't know. There's that God in heaven. There's the revealer of secrets. And I'm giving honor to him through his servant. Oh, God will say to it, yet, dear children of God, the earth's greatest will have to give the honors to Christ that he deserves to receive. And the very angels of God, as some of us were reminded recently, will worship as his kingdom is established. And if angels give him his rightful place in that coming day, men will have to give him his place and honor those who have been kept right with him. What about you, dear child of God?
Are you intimate with the secrets of God, are you?
You say you don't know anything about them, do you not?
Well, mind you, he's revealed them. He's revealed them. And the secret of the Lord is with them that fear him. Every child of God should have some idea of the program that lies ahead. God has let us into the secret. We don't be guessing at it. There's not a guess in what I've been giving you tonight. It is just as there on the surface for anyone to see. There's nothing complicated or confounding about it. God has fixed that. And God could tell it before it happened. And not only foretell what was coming, but so order circumstances that it did come and came at the very time when he had arranged it for God. Oh, we must remember when Daniel's giving thanks now, and Daniel's prayer, and this is worth studying, he gives thanks that God is a God of wisdom and a God of knowledge, and that he has all the secrets clear, and night and day are alike to him. But he also gives thanks that God is a God who changes times and seasons. And you know, as he thinks of God bringing spring and summer and autumn and winter, he just says, well, that same God is bringing summer and winter to the world's experiences. He's changing things in the world as well as in creation. Go on speaking, but we mustn't keep you there. We'll leave that for the moment. Wasn't it great that a human being could open his mouth and be used of God to disclose what's not fully fulfilled yet, and that's well over nearly 3,000 years ago, well over two anyhow, since those words were uttered. It's not all finished yet. But so far it has all been fulfilled, and the God that has fulfilled the past, we can leave it to him to fulfill the future. And so we ask his blessing.